Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We'll begin today with the weather and climate report. Weather is not climate, but consistent weather patterns reflect the state of the climate. So for one thing, maybe you've heard that globally, last month, July 2019, was the hottest month ever recorded on Earth. That's according to Europe's Copernicus Climate Change Service. Now, that might not mean so much by itself. Records get broken. But the context is that 2015 to 2019 are headed for being the warmest five-year period since they started keeping track. And you can find graphs online that show the gradual upward trend. In fact, since the start of the industrial emissions era around 1900. After learning that July 2019, last month, was the hottest month ever recorded in Earth's history, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said,
"We have always lived through hot summers, but this is not the summer of our youth. This is not your grandfather's summer."
Not your grandfather's summer. He booked that string quartet to play behind him and everything. No. But does that mean it's getting warmer evenly? Everywhere on Earth, evenly? No, quite the opposite. As the Washington Post reports, the temperature spike last month was driven largely by record warmth in Western Europe and noteworthy warmth stretching across the Arctic that culminated in one of the most significant melt events ever recorded in Greenland at the end of the month. It says the Greenland ice sheet poured 197 billion tons of water into the North Atlantic in July alone, enough to raise global sea levels by about 2/100ths of an inch, which by itself doesn't sound like much, but it adds up. Noteworthy extreme weather events, the Post also says, during July include a widespread heat wave in Western Europe, maybe you've heard about this, that set national temperature records in Britain, Germany, the Netherlands, and Belgium. Paris soared to its highest temperature ever recorded, 109 degrees one day in Paris. Yikes. Now, if you don't really care about Paris or Greenland, why would you? David Leonhardt crunched some numbers for the New York Times comparing recent years to the 20th century and found that Houston used to have 89 days above 90 degrees in a typical year. It now has 115. Atlanta has gone from 36 days a year over 90 degrees to 56, and Denver from 27 to 48. And by this measure, he writes, Boston of today feels like New York of the 20th century, and Washington is on its way to resembling the Memphis of old. Now, if we're still not close enough to home for you, consider this. There's a major new Washington Post study this week that finds New Jersey is one of the fastest warming states in the nation. The average temperature for your garden in the Garden State has climbed by more than 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit since 1895. That's more or less the beginning of the industrial emissions era. Double the average for the lower 48 states. The Post's massive new piece on the warming of America begins right in Lake Hopatcong, which has been in the news, as some of you know, for being deemed unswimmable for a time this month because of conditions largely caused by heat. So let's dive in. Let's not dive into Lake Hopatcong, but let's take a closer look with Stephen Mufsin, Business of Climate Change reporter at The Washington Post. Thanks for coming on, Stephen. Welcome to WNYC.
Glad to be here.
So why did that article written for national consumption begin in Lake Hopatcong?
Well, Lake Hopatcong is a great place to start because it was such a huge ice industry a century ago. The lake was that cold that people would come and cut ice anywhere from kind of 14 to 24 inches thick and send it off to ice boxes in places like New York in the days before refrigeration. So we have some great historical photos and accounts of that time. There were big carnivals out on the ice. People would drive their cars out there. 15,000 people would be out on the lake. They had these large ice boats that would sail across the icy lake on blades. So we had that sort of history to compare present day to. These days, it's very hard for them to get ice thick enough for people to go ice fishing without fear of falling in. So that was one reason what made it a good spot. The other reason is that the average temperatures in Lake Hopatcong have just surpassed, the average winter temperatures, I should say, have just surpassed 32 degrees. So that's, and you can see that clearly in the accounts about the ice thickness on the lake.
In other words, if the average winter temperature is above freezing, then the lake isn't going to stay frozen for very long.
Not over extended periods of time. I mean, of course, you can always, we can still get polar vortex incidents and cold snaps. So, this is not to say that lake will never freeze, but never, it's not going to be the same as it was before.
So, listeners, let's open up the phones right away. Your calls about warming summers, warming winters, what you used to be able to do in Lake Hopatcong. Anybody relate to what our guest was just saying? Do you remember driving a car out onto the lake for a winter festival? And or maybe your parents did it and now you don't do it, but you've heard those stories. Or any other questions or comments or stories at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Stephen Mufsen, climate change business reporter for The Washington Post. Now, you singled out the Northeast in general, New Jersey and Rhode Island in particular, in certain ways after looking at these stats. What did you find?
Well, one of the reasons possibly that the Northeast is warming faster is that the Gulf Stream has edged closer to the eastern seaboard. And that's, as you know, the Gulf Stream brings warmer water and warmer temperatures. And this was particularly dramatic in Rhode Island, where we found a sort of an unusual setup where a family had bought a large tract of land and then leased it out to 300-400 families. And they are right on the – they're in rows, and the row that's closest to the water was decimated during Hurricane Sandy. And so the family's been trying to convince people who live there to move back to the back row. There's a lot of people don't want to give up their ocean view, and the back row is right next to a cornfield. So people aren't too eager to do that. But I think now that they can actually see the shore eroding by several feet a year right in front of them, people are starting to move to the back.
In general, you found that warming in the U.S. is happening unevenly. Why would it happen unevenly?
Well, for a variety of factors. I mean, I think that part of it is not certain, but I think part of it's just that's the way climate change works. It's not exactly even across the world. There are also heat island effect issues in some places. This is, you know, mostly in cities where you have a lot of pavement, you might get a little extra bump in temperature there. And then it might be because of your proximity to a warm current like the Gulf Stream. And yet another possibility might be that you're in a place where the ice and snow is melting so fast, say in some mountainous areas, that their ability to protect us because ice and snow reflect solar radiation back out into the atmosphere, which is exactly what you want. But as snow and ice retreats, that warmth is going to be absorbed by the ground, and it sort of accelerates the whole process.
So as you found uneven warming around the country, you even found some regions of the country have cooled slightly. Can you tell us where?
Yeah, oddly enough, in Alabama and Mississippi, there are places where the average temperature has fallen since 1895. You can look at, it's a little bit of a mystery about why. One theory is that there was so much soot and other particulate matter in the air that it was blocking some of the warmth from the from the sun. But, you know, a lot of the country had those conditions. So it's a little bit of a mystery. If you look at the pattern and start your analysis around 1960 or 70, you do get a warming trend that's very similar to the rest of the country. So I'm not sure how much comfort that would be if you for Alabama and Mississippi.
Right. And before we take some calls, and our board is full of people who want to talk about this or ask you questions, we're thinking about heat now because it's August, but consistent with that Lake Hopatcong story about how you can't drive on the ice anymore, you found that in our area, winter has been transformed more than summer. Can you describe some of that?
Sure. We as you say, we tend to think of global warming as, you know, in places that are hot or in seasons that are hot. But the biggest changes across the country pretty much have been on the lower end of any temperature band. So the coldest parts of the year are getting warmer fastest, and the coldest part of each day is getting warmer fastest. And that has an impact not only on winters, but also on summer, because take Lake Hopatcong as another example. You have weeds that usually die off during the winter, and if there's sunlight coming through the ice, because the ice is thin, those weeds will be increased in number. And you see the same kind of thing with pests that kill agricultural products, because the larvae haven't been killed off in the winter, or insects like mosquitoes. I mean, God knows there are enough mosquitoes in New Jersey already. I grew up there and remember that pretty well. So, but you know, it's worse, and those carry diseases, and you're starting to see things like West Nile move up through New Jersey from places down here like D.C.
All right, talk about the insects. We've got an insects call. It's not an insect calling, but it's Brian in Park Slope calling about insects. Brian, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I have a garden in the backyard, and I had read in the Uninhabitable Earth, they talked about much more insects coming along as the leaves get thicker from all the carbon dioxide. And we just had a huge infestation of millipedes in my backyard. The other day, I've never seen them. I've lived here for 15 years. Not as many birds, strangely, but a lot more insects in our backyard.
Thank you very much. Do you know enough to know about millipedes?
I'm not up on the millipedes, but that seems like a possibility. We have seen something similar with things like pine beetles, eighth of an inch long critters that have invaded the pine barrens and killed off about 20,000 acres worth of pines.
I was going to go next to a call from Marjorie in Hastings, but she hung up. Marjorie, call right back, and I'll take your call about your memories on driving in ice other than Lake Hopatcong. 212-433-WNYC. Marjorie, we have an open line for you. 212-433-9692. In the meantime, Mitchell in Stuyvesant Town, you're on WNYC. Hello, Mitchell.
Hey, Brian, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
Good, I love your show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for this good work and making it as public as you are, because that's so important. I spend a lot of time, my organization is called A Better World, and a lot of what I do behind the scenes and on air has to do with letting people know about the seriousness of this situation. And I wanted to specifically mention my conversation with Dar Jamal, who wrote a book called The End of Ice, that I was thinking about as I was listening to you, which is just devastating. And maybe, do you know it? Are you aware of it?
I don't personally know it.
Yeah. It's just a situation of him traveling. He's a hiker. And he went around the world to all the highest peaks that he's been doing for the past 25 years. And they're all, you know, they're puddles now. And he talks with the leading scientists there, and we're just going in this direction. But do you think it's fair to say that what we're seeing is, I know we talk about global warming, and I think that's very real, but at the end of the day, we're talking about extreme weather patterns, the patterns being so disrupted going in both directions. And that helps to explain why we have, what, in some places, as you're saying, global warming and in others, global cooling.
Right. And some people call it global weirding instead of global warming. Stephen, can you put some meat on those bones? I mean, I think the basic here is global warming. That's so much of what's been documented, is this steady march of warming since the beginning of the industrial emissions era. But Stephen, how would you respond to Mitchell?
Well, I think he's hit on a very important point, which is that it's not just about warming, although, you know, the temperature is warming. It's also about extreme weather, and that can mean things like rainfall. I mean, New Jersey and actually here in D.C. also, we had 40-50% more rain last year than the average year. And this year is on track for another big increase. So I think that's a good example of something that could be extreme and have a bad effect. I talked to someone, actually this didn't get into the story, but who running a vineyard in New Jersey, and he said, you can plan for a lot of aspects of climate change. Maybe you're going to harvest the grapes earlier, or maybe you do this, that, and the other thing. But extreme events, unpredictable events like a lot of rain, that's hard to plan for, and that can ruin a crop. So I think that extreme weather is a very important part of climate change.
Here is Marjorie in Hastings calling back in. Hi, Marjorie. Thanks for chiming. Hi.
So I just called in because family lore had it, and I think my father told me this. He was born in Manhattan in 06, and he always claimed that he was able to drive his car across the Hudson River in the winter. I don't know how many times he did it, but I don't know if that's possible.
Well, it probably depends where in the Hudson River. I mean, we certainly see ice flows in the Hudson, even down here in the city. If you go further upstate, I mean, I've been near the top of the Hudson River in the Adirondacks. That it's much narrower, for one thing, and it certainly freezes over. Do you know where?
Well, my impression was that it was, you know, down south from out of Manhattan, but I don't know exactly. I don't know if that's possible.
But it's family lore, so it's interesting, at least in that respect, that there even is that kind of family lore, which Stephen maybe wouldn't be handed down from this generation.
I will say that the cars were probably a little bit lighter in those days, although still a lot heavier than, you know, than any other vehicle at the time. But if you go online to see our piece, you can see a 1925 vehicle out there parked comfortably in the middle of the lake while the owner is digging a hole to go ice fishing.
Marjorie, thank you so much. And if you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Mufson, Business of Climate Change reporter at The Washington Post, one of 5 Washington Post reporters who contributed to their massive new article, Extreme Climate Change Has Arrived in America, with lots of photos and lots of stats and lots of stories. Kathy in Tewksbury, New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. Talked to you before on different topics. This one hits home hard. We have a family cottage on the coast in New England, just south of Plymouth. The property was a King's land grant almost 400 years ago to my husband's family. The cottage is a little, literally a cottage. Now, there's no sheetrock inside. It's been sitting there since 1910. We lose about 10 feet of bank a year. We're up on a bluff. And 200 feet in my husband's lifetime. We're now about 30 feet from the bluff. Our septic is probably going to go over, and we have probably 700 feet of beach. We can't afford to fortify that. You know, it's millions of dollars to fortify it. We're talking about a cottage that, you know, probably we're going to pick up and move and have to put in a new septic, but it's not luxurious. It's not even, you know, we just see every year the water coming closer and closer and closer. And it's not like in New Jersey where we live, where the state you know, will do anything to save it. You know, there's no recourse whatsoever.
How do you tie what's happening on that bluff to global warming?
Well, the storms, it seems like the winter storms, and if you remember the news over the last, 10 years, the big storms in Plymouth that have washed away the beach there and the flooding south of Boston, it's been every winter, heavier winter storms. The other thing is we used to go down and just pick mussels on the beach, you know, and eat them. We rarely even see mussels anymore. They're gone. We have more seals. We've got lots of seals. We never had that. We've had great whites there. We never had that. So it's just interesting how much degrading of the land, how the species that are there have changed. And we're watching it, you know, sort of slide out from under us.
Thank you so much for that anecdotal evidence. Stephen, were you thinking anything in particular as you were listening to Kathy?
Absolutely. I mean, we're always a little hesitant to attribute anything entirely to climate change, but there are some aspects of climate change that would definitely be contributing to what she's seeing. For one thing, the sea is getting higher, and for another, it's in that area, it's getting warmer. So the mussels have probably migrated to the north, and as the seals and the great whites are probably doing the same thing. And the warmer and higher seas will also contribute to the erosion of the coast there. So I think it's probably safe to say that at the very least, climate change is contributing to what she's seeing in important ways.
You mentioned earlier that winter is warming in our region more than summer, and that's a theme of the article. And you wrote that that would be consistent with what scientists expect in most climate change models. Why would they expect that?
Well, they would expect it because I think of the reasons we were talking about before, which is that as the ice melts and the snow melts, you're going to get less. Those are the things that really are protecting us from the solar radiation coming from the sun. And if they're not there to reflect that back out to the atmosphere, then the ground is going to warm up faster and faster. As soon as the cover is gone, it's the plain ground that's going to be absorbing that heat.
Paul in Trenton. Paul, you're an entomologist, is that right?
That is correct, Brian. Thank you for this awesome topic. So to your guest, I'm curious, have you looked at what's been going on with climate change and then invasive species? And that's what I do here. And the spotted lanternfly, which is around Lake Hopatcong, and how I know Gary Lovett from the Cary Institute, one of your sponsors, has some awesome articles, some journal articles on this, and showing that as the climate change, you're creating even more invasive species, which is changing your forest types, and just keep on, fueling this fire. Have you looked into that at all?
Yes, we did. It's one of the things that we didn't quite have room for in the article. But you can see that, of course, as you know, in New Jersey, both the invasive species can have damaging effects. But then you're also seeing a change in the type of trees that are in New Jersey, so that you have tree species from down here, which are now moving up there at a pretty steady pace. The Department of Environmental Protection has a pretty good page about that.
Yeah, when I was thinking more of as you're changing the plant species, they're warming, you're basically creating that, the Goldilocks effect, the niche environment for native, or non-native species coming in, especially, we're the oldest operating port in North America. And as you mentioned, 3.5 degrees is quite significant. And when you mentioned the southern pine beetle, that is native. However, that expanded its range. All these different, creating the perfect storm here in New Jersey, as well as, spreading to other states.
Paul, thank you
so
much.
And some of these
Go ahead.
Some of these invasive species can reside in certain types of trees. So as the tree variety changes, that'll create homes for new insects.
Paul, thank you for your call. It's not every day we hear from an entomologist. And remember, etymologists study words. Entomologists study insects. Some of these threshold numbers that are in your article that people may not have heard before, 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit, average temperature higher in New Jersey than before the industrial era, measured compared to 1895, 3.5 degrees on average throughout the year, warmer. That's significant. That thing you threw in before about the average winter temperature in New Jersey is now a little above 32 degrees. So if it used to be 3.5 degrees colder, it was below, the average temperature was below freezing. The average temperature is now above freezing.
That's right. And that's one of the things contributing to that in Lake Hopatcong is that it's bordered on either side by, I believe it's Morris and Sussex counties, mm-hmm. and they have very high warming numbers. So that's probably contributed to what's happening in the lake.
We have a Sussex County call. Rachel in Nutley, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rachel.
Good morning, Brian. How are you?
Good. What are you seeing?
So I run a Girl Scout troop out here, and at the end of June, we did an outing at a Girl Scout camp in Sussex County, and we were asking about using the lake for some swimming and boating, and we weren't able to because there was a lot of algae in the lake at the time.
So the
when was this?
End of June.
End of June, right.
Now, my daughter went to the camp a month later, and they had cleaned it up, but it was, you know, already season, and we couldn't. It was Schwartzwood Lake, I think it's called.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Rachel, thank you. And it was the algae in Lake Hopatcong that made it unswimmable for part of this month. I think they did reopen it yesterday. But the algae is a result of warmer temperatures, right? That is greater,
that's right.
Greater algae. Algae, I think it's the warmth after a rainstorm that tends to create the algae. Do I have that right?
That's right. It usually also involves some nutrient runoff into the lake. But the warming is an important part of the whole chain of events.
Remember the caller who talked about family lore regarding driving a car on the Hudson down in, you know, the lower Hudson around here because it used to freeze over? Well, we have a follow-up call from Maki in Manhattan. Maki, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. So I just wanted to follow up real quick. I found this while I was doing a paper that I did in high school on the building of the Holland Tunnel. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why they built the Holland Tunnel was because in the old days before there were any tunnels or bridges across the Hudson, the only way to get goods back and forth across the river was by boat. And when the river would freeze over, it would obviously disrupt that. They could get stuff across by, like, as the woman said, like driving across somehow, either by car or by horse and carriage. But obviously, there's a lot less of that. And in one, I forget exactly when, but in the early 1900s or maybe late 1800s, it froze over for such a long time that it disrupted, the flow of goods into Manhattan, essentially, which essentially included food, and people started panicking that they were running out of food and stuff, and that was one of the reasons why they built the Holland Tunnel.
Really interesting. And, of course, the whole march of technology and march of nature and the way they interact are so interesting. Another part of your Lake Hopatcong story in this Washington Post article is, and I never thought of this before, how before refrigeration, they used to take a lot of ice out of Lake Hopatcong in the winter and actually bring it to New York City so they could sell ice on the street to people, right?
Yeah, well, it was for people's ice boxes. My father still called the refrigerator an ice box as long as I can remember. And as you said, for businesses and things like that.
Let me take one more call. Rebecca in Rutherford wants some advice. Let's see if you can give her the advice that she's looking for. Rebecca, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Uh-oh. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I live in Rutherford, just outside of Manhattan, and we have a community Facebook group where somebody posted this article, and much of the conversation has been around this is made up, or there was one in particular. It says, the Ice Age started 2.6 million years ago and lasted until around 11,700 years ago. So global warming has been around long before humans inhabited the Earth. How do we respond?
This is not an advice show, and our guest is not an advice columnist. He's a okay. business of climate change reporter for the Washington Post. But can you help Rebecca?
A little bit, because that's not my entire field of expertise. But I think that important distinctions can be made by geologists who have drilled into the ice in places like Greenland and other parts of the Arctic, and they've studied climate changes that have happened in other eras. So I think those are important to analyze, but the conclusions that they've come away with are that climate change now is because of man-made substances in the atmosphere. The number of particles of carbon and the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is playing a role in altering what would be natural climate change,
right,
and altering it quite dramatically.
Rebecca, are you talking about this article, this Washington Post article that our guest helped write, that's
right,
on this Facebook group, and the deniers are debunking it, trying to debunk it?
Right, and we live sort of on the front line here in New Jersey, especially adjacent to a toxic river, surrounded by industry. And it's just alarming to some of us that our own neighbors and fellow members of the community aren't taking it seriously.
Let me, you know what we do? I'm going to crowdsource this for you and see if you get any help from our crowd. So listeners on Twitter, why don't you use the hashtag #HelpRebecca? And because our guest is a business reporter who, you know, contributed to this article. He's not a scientist or per se a science journalist. So some of you know more than he does, know more than I do. Hashtag help Rebecca and give her the reasons, if you know them, assuming you think it's accurate, that the fact that there have been warming trends in way past human history before the one that we now associate with industrial era emissions, why that doesn't scientifically disprove man-made global warming. Rebecca, are you on Twitter to look at it?
Yes.
Good.
Thank
okay.
you.
Hashtag help Rebecca, and you can throw in at Brian Lehrer as well as another reference, and let's see what we get later on. And in the meantime, I'm going to ask you one more question. Just one other thing from the article, Stephen, because one thing you tried to correct for, even as they're talking about trying to correct for things that have happened, thousands or millions of years ago, was warming due to urbanization. That is, if the Northeast, if our region is warming faster than the rest of the country, which is what you found, it's also become more dense in population, and warming would be expected from that. Also from the greater ground level air pollution that comes with more people, with big cities. How much did those things actually matter?
They matter, but they don't matter exclusively. Because if you look at the map, another one of the fastest warming areas is in Minnesota, northern Minnesota. There's no urbanization of any significance happening there. There's a spot in eastern Utah, western Colorado. That's different from the urbanization effect. Also in the New York area, yes, the city has gotten hotter at a fast rate, but so have part, you know, the outer parts of Long Island and the Hamptons area. And, you know, yes, I know there are more mansions probably there than before, but it's fundamentally a beach area. It's not a lot of tarmac throwing off a lot of heat, and the same in Westchester. So I think the urban heat island effect, as it's called, has some effect, but it doesn't explain everything. It's still fundamental climate change and man-made climate change, which is really pushing things the most.
And with that data point, we leave it with Stephen Mufsen, Business of Climate Change reporter, one of five Washington Post journalists who contributed to their major new article this week. 2 degrees Celsius, beyond the limit, extreme climate change has arrived in America. Thank you so much for this time.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay tuned.